This is the PC Gamer Podcast for Thursday, April 14th, 2011, episode number 268. I'm Evan Lottie, senior editor at PC Gamer Magazine, and alongside me today here in our soundproof studio, Josh Augustine, associate editor.
Why, hello there.
He's really more across from you than alongside you.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. We are opposing.
It's important that people understand the seating arrangement here in the PC Gamer studio.
Across our leather-coated podcasting table.
Classy.
Yeah.
Classy.
To my left, of course, you just heard Dan Stapleton, reviews editor.
And that's about 90 degrees left.
90 degrees parallel, not perpendicular. I don't know. It's a nice, we got enough space in here, just three of us.
Yeah, we can kind of lay out a bit. I like it.
It's comfortable. And before we carry on here, I just wanted to say that I'm holding in our hands our Portal 2 issue that subscribers and newsstand visitors will be receiving soon.
Oh, so orange.
It's the most orange issue of PC Gamer you'll probably ever see.
Well, orange is since the orange box.
Since the orange box, true. Really exciting. We reviewed it. Dan and I have played it. We can't say anything about it, of course. But on that topic of Portal 2, and you know, we hope you guys are looking forward to that issue, but there have been some shenanigans being pulled by Valve leading up to the release of Portal 2. I mean, it's really interesting seeing them just get more and more aggressive and creative, arguably, with their marketing for a game. There is that sort of traditional... we've seen a lot of it here in San Francisco. I don't know what it's like in other cities in the U.S., but tons of outdoor
billboards
and
buses,
like bus stickers and things like that for Portal 2. A lot of TV ads. I see them on Adult Swim and things like that, and I forget what other networks, but it's really prevalent. But in addition to that, online, Valve has been running this really interesting ARG that has been just crazy to follow.
Now, we should explain what an ARG is.
Because I hate that.
Yeah,
I hate that phrase.
Also, honestly, I didn't... I saw people talking about the Valve ARG. I'm like, what is an ARG? Like, I know what it is, but I've never heard it referred to as an ARG.
Yeah, it's an alternate reality game, basically. So it's... In this case, you can think about it as it's bringing the game's fiction into quote-unquote real life to play a game that usually involves like sort of crowdsourced puzzle solving, things like decoding of like secret messages in WAV files and things like that, or
drink more Ovaltine.
Yeah, whip out your decoder rings for Portal 2. So there's been a lot that's taken place so far. I'm sort of struggling to pull it all together here, but what we've sort of found out yesterday, and this is really creative. So the people that on the Steam forums and elsewhere that I guess were most responsible for helping solve the elements of this puzzle. Like, for example, there's a Steam other podcast called the Steamcast. Guys cover PC games. And there was text revealed in the spectrogram, like, you know, the sort of frequency, the waveform of the podcast itself that was seemingly from GLaDOS. And I guess people, excuse me, that have been trying to contact these people over Steam and accessing their YouTube accounts, they've sort of been hacked by GLaDOS. So we saw like an image of a Steam conversation that one of the people that was like responsible for solving one of these puzzles or you know, had made some of the most progress was basically posing as GLaDOS. And they were saying, like, their friend was saying to them something like, "Hey, what's up? Are you busy?" And the other guy replies back, "Yes, I am busy doing safe things that are supervised by a responsible safety associate." And like, just things that were like clearly not his voice, and like that he'd been taken over, and that's just like such an interesting and aggressive way. I mean, Valve controls that infrastructure; they can do what they want with it. It's kind of a creative way of making GLaDOS and the spirit of the game kind of infect everything. So, pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy just how prevalent it is. Like, a bunch of games came out with updates that kind of put Portal 2 stuff into the game, or levels that were specifically for Portal 2, like Audio Surf, instead of the car or spaceship, I forget, whatever it is that you're flying, you know, it's the Portal 2 gun that you're controlling around. I mean, just the sheer amount, like any one of these would have been like, hey, that's a cool marketing trick or something, but they're doing like 10 of them total over the course of, I mean, the game's still, what, 2 weeks out? Even more?
Next Tuesday.
Only 1 week. Oh, okay. Yeah. So they've been preloading now. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I don't know, does it seem like too much to you guys? Because to me, this is really cool. I'm not the kind of person that gets involved in this and solving the problems, but I like seeing the answers that the community comes up with. But I mean, this is just a huge marketing push for Portal 2, which is arguably a huge game. But I mean, they never did anything like this for like Half-Life 2 or anything like that, did they?
I don't think so. I mean, again, we were talking a couple weeks ago about the way that Valve likes to use each of their games as an opportunity to experiment, like the microtransaction business model for TF2 now. That's a significant experiment. And with this, I mean, it's sort of a natural fit where GLaDOS is an evil AI, so they can do fun things with that. And just to list a couple more of the games, I mean, Bit Trip Beat, Killing Floor, Defense Grid, The Ball, and Audio Surf, like you mentioned, Josh, they basically got Portal-themed content, whether that's like a new level or just some kind of, piece of GLaDOS up in there, which is...
Was The Ball, did they replace The Ball with a companion cube? Or
I don't think so. I think there's a level that has like lasers through it, basically. I think it takes place in one of the GLaDOS Aperture facilities. So,
yeah, I don't like a lot of advertising beating me over the head, but you know, as long as it's a creative ad, you know, like I'll watch the Super Bowl, and even though I'm not a football fan, I'll watch the Super Bowl because I know there's like some going to be some creative funny ads, and you know, I'm probably not going to. It's not going to affect my buying decisions, but these things are kind of by nature entertaining in of themselves, and it's free content. Yeah. So, I mean, things like getting a new Defense Grid level, I'm all about that. I wish more people would would promote their games by giving me a free Defense Grid level. So yes, please do more of it. And yeah, I think it definitely is the first time Valve has done anything like this, at least to this scale. But I hope they do more because I think it is more effective than a billboard.
And Evan, did I hear you right that some of this was like found by looking at wavelengths of the audio podcast? Like, how do people figure that stuff out? That's insane.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm sure they got a hint or something, or yeah. There was like a clearly, you know, I'm sure that audio itself that turned into words didn't sound right.
Yeah, you can see the image of the waveform on PCGamer.com. There's a post about it.
Okay, I'm just always impressed by just the talent and creativity of these like crowdsourcing things, where people can dig into this crazy stuff that I would have never thought to do, and even if I thought to do it, I'd have no clue how to go about doing it. Like, it's always impressive to me.
Yeah. So Valve continues to surprise us. There's even like a rumor circulating that Portal 2 will release early,
if everything is solved.
If everything, yeah. So. Yeah. There might be some element of unlocking the puzzle and unlocking the game early. It's certainly letting the game preload this early, you know, a week in advance. Is that something they've done before?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been at least a few days to a week. I don't have those exact numbers, but it doesn't seem like an unusual preload period.
But I mean, a game launch like this, especially for something that's co-op, it has servers and stuff like that. I mean, the launch day is so important. And I mean, retail, obviously, do you think all these retail places have boxes and are just having to wait until people solve this puzzle?
Well,
I mean,
generally the retailers get their copies on Tuesday. So they could have it now, or they could be getting it next Tuesday, on launch day. So, they tend to avoid with the bigger games. I believe they tend to avoid getting them to retailers early because then you get broken street dates.
So, I mean, So are you saying you don't think it's possible that they'll release it early?
I think it's most likely that like if somebody solves some individual person solves it, they will let that person play it early.
Okay.
That would be my guess. Or you know, maybe they would have some limited amount of people that could play it early.
Yeah.
But I think the retailers would be very upset if Valve were to allow people to play Portal 2 on PC first, which would be. We would not be upset. We would be very happy.
Yeah, maybe the final clue turns out to be a code or something. And if you put it in Steam, you get it early, and it works like 10 times or something.
Yeah, it could be something limited like that.
I just want to add to, if you guys remember, PlayStation 3 copies of Portal 2 come with a free PC version of Portal 2, and there's sort of been some. I've heard a little bit on message boards, people being like, "Well, what do PC players get out of it?" What we get out of it are new PC players. That's awesome. Like, I don't think I can't remember any better like evangelizing by a single publisher to directly get. I mean, just the fact that it's a co-op game, and you know, a ton of people play the first Portal. They're going to want to say, "Oh, my friend doesn't have a PS3. I don't want them to spend what's a PS3 like $400 these days or $300? Yeah, I don't want them to have to go out and make that purchase. But they do have an okay gaming PC. I'm going to install Steam for them and get them hooked up to play. That's awesome.
Yeah,
yeah,
It is a pretty ingenious move by Valve, really. But you know, it does, you know, give the impression that you know, if you buy the PlayStation 3 version, you're getting a better deal. And in fact, why wouldn't you buy the PlayStation 3 version if you're going to get the PC version anyway?
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I guess technically it costs $60, right?
Right. And right, it'd be $10 more for.
Right now, you can pre-order it for $45.
That's right.
That's been going on for months.
Right.
Anywho, further on the topic of secrets, Dan Stapleton told me that there's some Mass Effect 3 information or confirmations of questions that we had before that we have answers to now.
Well, my friend Game Informer told me because they had the exclusive on reveal on Mass Effect 3. And there are some very interesting things in there. Most notably, most important to me anyway, or the thing that made me breathe a sigh of relief is that there is no multiplayer mode. Which, I mean, it's kind of weird to be saying thank God there's not an extra feature, but just based on the fact that the previous two Mass Effects have been single player only, I would have hated to have seen it diluted down into. You know, and potentially have resources taken away from finishing out this great single player trilogy, and put into a multiplayer mode that may or may not be any good. So, that's great news. Other than that, you know, it's staying away from any spoilery territory. There's some information on how the game opens, and what circumstances are going on at the time of the Reaper attack on Earth that was shown in the trailers, and there have been sightings of Rex, Morden, Legion, Anderson, Caden, and Ashley. I guess it depends on which one you killed in Mass Effect 1, and a few other people. But
was Liara on that list?
Not in this list, but I mean, I would be shocked if she didn't show up. So. Oh yes, Liara is in this list. Sorry.
Excellent.
And Garrus as well.
Not so excellent.
You didn't like Garrus in Mass Effect 2?
He was better in 2, but he was still kind of boring.
Yeah, I liked Garrus. So you know, it's not a whole lot of shocking stuff there in the cast list. Elusive Man is also back. Cerberus is trying to kill you, and what else? Oh yeah, they're promising deeper RPG elements, which is good. I mean,
ooh, deeper.
Yes.
I mean, tell me more.
There's nothing terribly specific.
What the hell does that mean? Yeah.
Nothing terribly specific except that abilities will have multiple tiers of upgrades. So
cool.
So it won't be. It seems like they are reacting somewhat to the you know, and there a lot of fair criticism of Mass Effect 2 was that the RPG aspects were fairly shallow.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I hope they bring back some form of the inventory, but not as terribly designed.
Yeah, the inventory in both games was very weak. You know, the presence of an inventory was poorly implemented, and the absence of an inventory was kind of a gaping hole in Mass Effect 2. So, hopefully they will find some happy middle ground. Like multiple endings. Any class will be able to carry any weapon, but only the soldier will be able to carry all at once. And there are weapon mods that are back. So,
man, that doesn't sound like too much. I'm not really impressed with that exclusive. If that's the best information they got,
I mean, it's still
something, but it's
again staying away from the story spoilery stuff, which you can find, you know, if you look for it. But I don't want to burn anybody's ears.
So the question I have for you guys: are you guys happy with how your Mass Effect 2 ended up? Kind of looking forward to Mass Effect 3. Are you ready to port that game over, or do you need to go back and kind of tweak it?
I'm going to replay it, certainly, just to get warmed up again, refamiliarize myself.
Yeah,
I want to go back and replay Mass Effect 1 and 2, mostly because I've played both of them in such start and stop ways, and you know, multiple times, that I don't feel like I have a definitive. Like, this is my Mass Effect experience. So I want to get a really long running start and get into Mass Effect 3 that way. Although that is, that's big talk, but, because it is a lot of time commitment there. That's what, like, minimum of like 70 hours of, playing through.
I did get through the original in like a 3-day weekend, I think. That's pretty much all I did in the 3-day weekend.
Right.
But I was able to get through it. And I love consuming games like that, just in one big chunk, like story games. I mean, you remember who everybody is. All their betrayals are more poignant because it's like, last night you saved my life. Why would you stab me now?
So, yeah, and it would be ideal if I could do that. I don't know if I'm going to have time. But that is my ambition.
All right, just a couple PSAs before we move on to our next topic. Hey, the Boltstorm soundtrack is free, so that's something. Dan, you described it as a overdramatic Michael Bay kind of film soundtrack.
It's definitely, it would not be out of place. And anybody who's played the game, I mean, you probably if you're like me anyway, when you play an action game like that, you're not really paying attention to the music unless the music is really bad, and then you're like, oh my god, this is the worst music I've ever heard. Turn off the music and play my own music in the background. But in this case, like, that, it is like really, but it's quality music, and there's like an hour of background music you could probably put to an actiony MMO if you're sick of that music and stuff like that, and it's free.
Okay, so go get it. I'm assuming it's on the Boltstorm website.
It's on their community site. There's a link on our site as well. So.
Outstanding. And also the third Humble Indie Bundle is taking place right now. At the time that we're podcasting here on Thursday, it's reached $520,000. So this one is dedicated to games produced by Frozenbyte, European developer. They made Trine. That's kind of what they're most known for now. So within that package, you do get Trine. You get Shadowgrounds Survivor, Splot, and a prototype game that they did not release, called Jack Claw.
The Shadowgrounds game, I never made the connection that Shadowgrounds and Trine were made by the same people. They're dramatically different games. And Shadowgrounds is a top-down shooter. And it's actually, I enjoyed it a lot. I reviewed it probably, 4 or 5 years ago. I think it came out around the same time as Doom 3. So maybe like 6 years ago now. Jesus. But it actually looked really good at the time. Had like cool lighting effects and just some cool weapons. It's just a fun top down shooter. It's not anything mind blowing, but really enjoyable game. And Trine too, great, really entertaining game.
Great. Yeah. So check it out. You can pay what you want. Don't pay a penny, because then all the people watching the dynamically generated revenue ticker will see you. we'll see that penny, and
then you will be shamed.
Yeah. We'll see that penny, and they'll be like, "Why do you do that?" Yeah. I was watching it last night. And I kept seeing like $1, $1, $100, $1, and it's like, "Come on, guys, this isn't like your excuse to be like to basically torrent the game for nothing." Like, help these guys out. It's a great program, and just support this as a business model. We're going to see more of it if it's successful, right? I mean, part of it comes out of the success of bundles on Steam and just deep discounts on Steam, but the flexibility that we have in PC to put games on sale without a lot of approval is really exciting, and we want to continue to benefit from that. So support it if you feel like it, please.
Yeah, because they also let you decide how you want to split up the money between the developers, the charities, and stuff like that. So if you happen to hate orphans with diseases, I mean, you can give it all to the developers if you want.
And it's hard to split up a penny. So
exactly. Yeah, I think they might actually lose money on the credit card transaction.
Yeah, plus the bandwidth.
Yeah, if it's less than that, so...
Yeah, so, yeah, you're going to get some enjoyment out of these games, so,
they're DRM-free. You can give them to other people, like, give them to your cousin or something.
Well, yeah, I mean...
As a gift.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Buy, get a copy for them.
Yes.
Yeah, so... But, yeah, I mean, it's just throw them a couple bucks. It's good games.
All right, so those are our public service announcements for this episode of the podcast, so... Josh, one story that was blowing up on our website last week, you handed this off to Lucas. I thought it was really smart that we got this up over the weekend, but a WoW character named Everbloom. Are they based in the United States? Do we know?
No, we don't really know. It is North American servers.
Okay.
So
presumably...
Probably somewhere around here.
Presumably in the U.S. or Canada. They reached level 85, which is the max level in World of Warcraft, without killing any enemies. And they only completed one quest, but that was by accident. They opened a letter, and that, you know, triggered a quest completion. So all they did was what exactly to reach level 85?
Well, with Cataclysm, they started giving XP for gathering herbs and mining minerals around. And also, there's a new profession, archaeology, where you kind of go around the world. It's basically like mining. You go to a certain part of the world, dig up stuff, and then like use tools to see, try and find the buried stuff in the ground and dig it up, and you get XP for that as well. So that's pretty much all they did. So basically, move, click to gather, move again, click to gather something else, and just flying around these areas and then exploring, because just by revealing places, you get XP. So they have they've done crazy math to figure out like the most optimal way to explore the world. Because if you explore too early, you don't get maximum XP. If you explore too late, you don't get the most XP. So they have it all figured out, like what levels you should explore every little part of the world and gather all this mining and herbing. I mean, I did it for like 3 levels where I was just like, hey, I wonder if I could just mine and herb for a few levels. And I did that. That was fun. But I can't possibly imagine like and not doing any quests at all, because quests are that's what makes the game fun. Like, hey, I'm helping people. I want to be a part of this story. No, he just went out. He or she, we don't know. Went out and just herbed.
So what's your best guess on how long that took them? Of in-game time, yeah.
Yeah. A normal player, I assume that they're experienced. An experienced player can probably level, I don't know, like 7 days played, maybe somewhere around there, 6 or 7 days played time, normally doing the optimal route. So it had to be at least... I'd say at least 25, 30 days played.
Wow. Of mind-numbing, grueling.
Yes. Of what Eric did in Mass Effect, basically.
Right.
That's just astonishing that, I mean, like, going to that, I mean, what did they get out of it? I mean, it's like, yes, they got a news post on PCGamer.com, but what do you get? What's the reward?
I have to admit, like, as soon as I saw it, like, I almost took it as, like, a challenge. Like, oh, I bet I could do that, too. Like,
Oh, no.
I talked about it on Twitter, and instantly I got, like, 20 people telling me I was probably mentally retarded. the appeal there is essentially kind of, if you're playing in this world, and I played World of Warcraft almost exclusively for, like, 3 or 4 years when I was in college. And when you're playing in this world, you just want to find new ways to explore this world and kind of set up arbitrary rules on yourself. Like, you know, there's the role-playing guy, the guy that did pacifism, which is essentially what this guy did, just it's easier now because you get XP for mining. But it's just like, let's see if I can do this. And then you just set it out and it's goal. And then like what he said was every level he got was a huge achievement because he worked so hard for it. And so I guess it's just being able to say in this world filled with millions of other players, you've done something unique. Like, you are special in this world. You've done something that no one else has.
Right. Because it was there, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, so instead of, you know, we can debate those merits all day, whether he was just, it wasn't an achievement, he was just spending time, anybody can do it, or, yeah, you know, he was just, you know, extending the life of the game by personalizing it. You know, you can go back and forth on that, we can debate that, but, yeah, Josh, you posed a great question of how do we as players, in different genres even, extend the life of the games we love. I know, Dan, you love Fallout. You played New Vegas through 3 times now.
Two and three quarters.
Yeah. And just get some feedback on what our playing styles are and how we do that. Because just myself personally, I definitely believe in most situations, not like trying to over game the game. It's kind of a weird phrase, but like not focusing so much on beating the game, but just on enjoying yourself and doing. In some cases, that requires a lot of restraint, right? Because you see an easy headshot, you want to take it, but maybe you want to dismantle this enemy in front of you by shooting their legs out and then seeing them ragdoll or something. You know, it's little things like that, little decisions like that that are maybe better to apply.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the most memorable thing I've done with something like that is with the original XCOM, where you know, there are some balance problems in that game, where, for example, you get mind control, and if you cultivate that quite a bit, you can dominate every level, every tactical battle towards the end by just mind controlling the aliens and lining them up and then executing them.
which is a great time.
Right, right.
The first few times.
Yeah, the first few times. But it gets old because there's no challenge to it. And, you know, you can set up factories where you manufacture laser rifles and then sell them for a profit and have basically unlimited money. And you get the highest end weapons. You get everything and everybody has it. Everybody on your squad has it. So you go through and you say, okay, this time I'm not going to research mind control at all. Or this time I'm not going to research heavy plasma. It increases the challenge of the game greatly and it fixes some of the balance problems and, you know, kind of creates new ones by swinging the pendulum in the other direction. But it is an interesting new way to experience the game.
That's terrific. I mean, it reminds me of one of my favorite columns Deslock has done for us recently in the magazine. This is from issue 212. It's got the 20 years of awesome, the big Blizzard feature we did on there. And he's basically talking about, like, there's one line I'm going to pull out, and he says, immersion isn't only the game's responsibility, it's yours too. I think, like, some players have a certain sense of entitlement where it's their instinct, and, like, you know, that's fine. This is a useful part of QA, almost, from a developer's perspective. Like, some players just want to break the game. They want to win the fastest way possible. That's how they have fun. That's totally cool. But I think it's useful to sort of adopt this perspective or this mindset while playing it, like, I'm responsible for my own immersion, right? Like, I shouldn't necessarily try to min-max in all situations, maybe. Like, RPGs are probably the best example of that because you're valuing your development of a character or characters and things like that. And there are certainly opportunities, like Dan mentioned, even in modern games like Dragon Age, probably. Maybe you have an anecdote about that, Josh. We can exploit a certain spell combination or something. But then you just kind of becomes a puzzle game where you're faced with enemies and it's like, oh, this combo, I'm done.
Yeah, hell, I'd love to see somebody try and beat Dragon Age Origins without a mage.
Yeah,
there's one.
Yeah, one thing I'm doing in Dragon Age 2 actually is my rogue. I'm not taking any direct damage abilities. I'm using all, like, I don't know what you would call them. I guess, like, manipulation things. Like, you teleport to the side of your ally, or you know. Disorient the enemy and then all that sort of stuff. So it's more like I feel like a trickster. And so that's one choice I'm doing. Like, it's so tempting to get backstabbed where you just one shot. But it's, no, I want it to be more interesting than that. So instead, you know, I have to control them in certain areas, then teleport over there and distract them and set their attention over there. And it's tough, especially when you're in situations where you're separated from your group, or like, oh no, you know, two of your people just abandoned you and it's just you and you have no attack moves. But that's just one of the ways I love to make it more challenging, but interesting at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. That's terrific. I think my example is, so Arma is certainly a game that is not optimized for balanced multiplayer in any way, really. There are some mods and some sort of rule sets that modders create that try to simulate that. But even then, for example, like a thermal weapon scope, and like there's a couple weapons that don't have a lot of bullet drop. So you can really, if you're a good player, you can really dismantle people. But anyway, one of the things, like, I've sort of adopted through our PvP sessions on our server, which we occasionally have, and it's really kind of in a spirit of fun, like, we just want to try something different and shoot each other for a while instead of the AI, is, like, if I'm faced with a situation where I have a rocket launcher and I can easily dismantle this APC, I can single shot and kill three people and, you know, hurrah, but maybe I'll just fire it over their head and, like, know that I'm generating some fear and, like, some drama on the other side, like, through their voice comms and things like that. Or maybe I'll pick up there's a gun called a Lee Enfield. It's kind of a World War I weapon. It's like a bolt-action rifle.
Old school. I like it.
Really bad. Maybe I'll pick up one of those instead and just see what I can do with it and challenge myself, and everybody will have a good laugh about it. You know, it's like stimulating those moments of just fun rather than playing it like a sport or playing it like chess, you know? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to do. Kind of in MMOs, a lot of times you end up going back and helping people that are a lot weaker than you or something like that, just because the way the system is set up. And that's what I do a lot of times, because if you go back and you, just like Arma, if you pull out the big guns and you blast them, I mean, it's no fun. So a lot of times, like, I'll intentionally miss or just kind of try and, like, dance around and hit each of them once, then just try and take the damage but not actually kill them or anything like that. And the other thing I love in League of Legends specifically is I love finding champions. There's just a list that a few of the blogs put out, like ranking the champions each week. Kind of, this is a tier one champ, this is tier three, tier four, tier five, or whatever. I love going to that bottom tier of champions and being like, okay, how can I make this champion good? So I played Shaco for a long time, and then as soon as he got popular, I was just like, it makes me sound so hipster, but it was just like, oh, okay, you know, okay, he's popular now. I don't want to play him. No one's playing Evelynn. Okay, let's see if I can make Evelynn good. And then I love feeling like that sense of the underdog, like I'm finding ways to use bad tools, but finding ways to make it work.
All right, so on the topic of truthiness and falsity questions, I just have one, and it's not a true or false, but sort of counts anyway. We asked our Facebook followers yesterday, go find us at facebook.com/PC Gamer Magazine. I feel like such a shill. We asked what the best PC gaming villain was. I love these kind of questions. There's like a new polling tool on Facebook, and you can see the results in real time. And 10 villains there. You know, we couldn't get everybody in. I think we got a good mixture. I'm going to read them off right now, and I want to hear what your guys' selection was and a little justification for that. So we had Diablo. We had Kerrigan. We had the G-Man from Half-Life. We had Carmen Sandiego. We had Andrew Ryan. Some people don't think he's really a villain. I think he is. I don't know. The AWP, a.k.a. the AWP from Counter-Strike. Who else am I missing? Arthas from World of Warcraft. And I think there was one more. I can't remember.
Obviously not a very memorable villain.
Oh, GLaDOS. GLaDOS was leading the list.
Oh, duh. Yeah.
Of course. GLaDOS is leading right now. Josh, who did you pick?
I voted for Arthas, although I still think he's a tragic hero instead of a villain. But if he's on that list, I think he is the most interesting and engaging character. I just love his story arc. It feels like a real person facing real hard choices. That it wasn't just, oh, he's an evil villain that's causing all this trouble. Like, you actually saw him fall from greatness and become the villain. And it is a really interesting story.
So that fall is convincing. You know, I'm not as familiar with the World of Warcraft story, but it is, you know, the good guy becoming the bad guy is certainly a template that's been done before, but you think it's convincing in this case or interesting?
I think it is. And in the end, you kind of find out that even when he was the bad guy, he was still kind of doing it for good reasons, essentially.
That undermines his villainitude then.
I know. That's why I think he's more of a tragic hero. Okay. Like, he's more of a Macbeth or something, he did all this evil, and, well, Macbeth has no real redeeming values. Never mind. Hamlet, maybe? I don't know.
Sure. One of those guys. I voted for the AWP. Of course I did.
Yes. I think that's the most clever one on the list. I think that's fantastic.
Even more so than Carmen Sandiego?
Yes. Because I hate the AWP much more than Carmen Sandiego.
There's no greater villain than the weapon that made you stop playing a game forever.
Possibly uninstall it.
I mean, Counter-Strike, obviously, is one of the most played games on Steam and PC gaming in general, but there's no measurement for how many people it's scared away from Counter-Strike, I think. It's such a powerful gun. You know, you can call it unbalanced if you want, but I think it's just more intimidating. It is a if any weapon is a character that sort of became a personality, like earned a reputation over time. I can't think of another one in a multiplayer game that was just so infamous and banned on so many servers. It's like the sheriffs of these servers basically kicked the AWP out of their out of their town. Yeah. You know, they it's just such an interesting bit of history, and it's awesome.
Yeah, and when you got headshot, you didn't curse Joe Schmo, the guy using it. You cursed the AWP.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So why are those Counter-Strike servers so against the Second Amendment? I have to kind of take issue with that. I don't think of it as a villain. It has no motivations. It has no character.
It wants blood. Your blood.
In the context of what is PC gaming's greatest villain? I mean, like,
Well, then why not just have like the the Xbox on there? I mean, you know, it's
well, maybe that's maybe we should have. I remember somebody mentioning that in the comments. It's consoles,
right? No, I mean, I think of that as a different category. And you know, when I think of a great villain, I think of something that is like Josh was saying, something that has you know, kind of interesting reasons for what they're doing, not just being evil for the sake of evil. Much, I guess you could say, the AWP is being evil for the sake of evil. But
so who's your go-to for that then?
Off that list, I would pick Gladys.
Okay.
I mean, she is a very interesting character that is more than what she first appears to be. You know, hilariously written, hilariously well acted, and just a really interesting presence throughout the entire game, throughout both games, really. Which you will soon find out.
All I'm saying, Dan, is that if I got to the end of Portal and instead of GLaDOS there was a giant op sitting there, I would have been more terrified.
But you would probably quit out of the game.
That's true.
Now, I don't want a villain to make me stop playing a game. I want a villain to make me keep playing a game.
Yeah. Well, sure.
That's what a good villain does, is make you want to come back and fight them more, not make you want
scared
to stop fighting.
Yeah. Interesting. Other two I didn't mention were Kane and Shodan. Shodan, sort of arguably a ancestor to GLaDOS, kind of, sort of.
And, angry AI. Yeah.
And Kane, the ageless villain, spoiler, alien.
Maybe,
who knows, in Command & Conquer. But yeah, head over to Facebook or leave a comment in the post for this podcast and let us know who your favorite villain is. If it's somebody else, we'd love to hear that explained as well.
Kane was interesting until Command & Conquer 4.
Indeed.
But only because there was the mystery. You didn't know what his motives were. You didn't know what his end game was. And then it turned out to be something lame.
Just like that Quantum of Solace movie, right? Oh, man. I mean, that's the least Bond villain I've ever seen. The guy stole water from people.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't even really remember the villain. And, you know, it's the whole concept of, you know, we were talking about who are the greatest heroes and greatest villains in gaming. There are so few games where you remember both the hero and the villain.
And that's
something that is dramatically different between movies and you know, any other storytelling medium and games.
That's really true. That's interesting. I mean, I think in a lot of cases, games that have a strong villain, the player is a blank slate. I mean, Portal's an example of that. Half-Life 2,
BioShock
is an example of that.
But you know, then you've got the converse, where the player is taking on the persona of a cool character, such as Duke Nukem, such as Lara Croft. You know, where the, you know, a lot of the fun comes from. I am this very powerful character, and also you could also throw in like Crisis in that and things like that. But you know, I am this very powerful character, and I am doing these. I'm brushing aside these weak enemies.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard with the way this game has sort of displays its exposition. But maybe KOTOR is maybe the exception to that, where both the character and the villain are.
Yeah, but BioWare games, I would say, are a rare exception to that, because they are so strongly written, and a lot of RPGs, in fact, are. Although, like, you look at Fallout, and that, like, a lot of RPGs, I should amend that, a lot of RPGs where the character is somewhat fixed, because if it's a character, if it's a game like Fallout, for example, then the player character is a blank slate that you can remake as you choose, so there's nothing to remember.
Let's play some questions for this week.
Hey, this is Bill from Long Island, aka Rush Maniac on Steam. I was wondering what you guys play on when you're doing your reviews and, you know, checking out the games. Do you use like GTX 560, 570? And also, what resolutions do you guys play on? Do you usually play on 1080p, or do you play on 1900 by 1200? I was just curious, that way, you know, have a better understanding of what you guys are actually looking at and playing. And keep up the great work, and love the podcast. Bye.
Well, it's kind of a wide variety. We all have different setups. I'm on GTX 570, I believe. I play on my 1080p HDTV using as my monitor. So, I guess Evan, you're on ATI right now, /AMD.
Yeah, I've got two 5850s in Crossfire and a Core i5. I mean, all of us use Windows 7, right? Duh.
Yeah, at home, at least, yeah.
Everybody should be using Windows 7. Yeah, what about you, Josh? You've got something nice.
Yeah, Chris just handed me a new one that I put in. I don't remember what it is, to be honest. Sadly enough. I was using ATI before, and this new one's NVIDIA. I know that, but I don't remember the numbers.
That's why I've kind of forgotten which one I'm using too, because I just put in a new one, but I forget exactly which model it is. Until then, I was using a Radeon 5870, I believe.
I was using a 5850 before on Devin.
And then like at the office, we have actually much older computers, because we take like the powerful gaming ones home, because that's where we do most of our gaming at the office is mostly. Mostly just, you know, working on the magazine and podcasting. For example.
Yeah, it's nice kind of having both ends. And I mean, we can test the games on low end systems as well in the office. And a lot of times, if it's a fairly low demanding game, I'll try it on my netbook too, just to see if it can run on a netbook. So that's something great to point out if it can.
Hey, this is ZioC12 calling. I just wanted to ask you a question about the recent announcement that Crysis 2 will be getting full DirectX 11. Patched in later on. I'm just wondering how you think that will change the graphics and whether or not it shows that the PC version was the dominant version in terms of sales. And just, like, what you expect, like tessellation on textures, all the fancy stuff that's been incorporated with DirectX 11. So, love the podcast, guys, love the magazine, and give them a good work. Bye-bye.
Yeah, we have been following some interest in this. Of course, people seem very concerned with DirectX 11, and kind of our stance. I mean, Dan and I kind of talk about this. Is the game looks great? Okay, like the game looks straight up beautiful as is.
The way it looks is the least of its problems. I mean, it's got some problems, but looking pretty ain't one.
Certainly, and. You know, we're all about the highest, you know, most advanced technology. It's something we certainly trumpet around. But is it really going to make a difference at this point? I mean, it's cool that they're adding it in after launch. It certainly seems to indicate that it wasn't a huge priority to begin with. But at the end of the day, you have one of the best looking. I think it's the best looking game on PC right now, and it can only get better. That's cool, but it's not a huge deal. Right. It's certainly not like. A huge loss or really cause to complain that much, I think. I mean, that we're getting it another month after launch.
Right. But, I mean, it does show that they didn't, you know, write it off completely and say, oh, we didn't get around to it, so we're just not going to do it. So it does indicate that Crytek is at least intending to continue supporting the PC version above and beyond what they're doing for consoles, which is good. It will almost certainly make some graphical difference. I don't think we've seen side by side what the difference is going to be, I would expect better, things to look bumpier. Really, I mean, more detail in the textures, more subtlety to ground and wall textures and things like that. Maybe smoke effects will look better. I really don't know until we see what specifically they choose to enhance. With new technologies,
so. More textured textures, Dan.
Right,
that's what it'll
bumpier
be.
Textures is really what seems to be the biggest, most noticeable effect of most DirectX 11 stuff I've seen.
Hey there, PC gaming crew. This is Mervyn Bunter. I have a question for your truthiness and falsity section. True or false? A legitimate PC game rental service would greatly benefit PC gaming. Thanks and keep up the good work.
I'll say true. I mean, any new way we can get a hold of to consume PC games, that's great. I guess it does kind of depend on, you know, how you're looking at, you know, who is benefiting. Is it benefiting the gamer or is it benefiting the business of PC gaming? I don't know if the latter is so true because the guys that are making the games wouldn't necessarily make more money as a result, because, and you know, honestly, they would be in a situation where, oh god, you know, we can't make this crappy game that we're going to make some money off of because people would buy without playing it first, which and of course that does benefit the gamer, so good.
Yeah, I was trying to think, like, even if it's like Netflix, which I think is a great model, I just don't think I would take advantage of it. The thing I love about PC gaming is just that these games, I can keep them forever on my hard drive. Like, I don't have to worry about the next iteration of the console or something, wiping it out. Like, even, like, the only thing I was thinking, maybe adventure games, but I love jumping back to old adventure games. Any sort of RPG I definitely want to keep. I guess I tend to jump into my older games very often, and so I don't see much value in.
Well, you know where it's going to happen, if it happens at all, is something like online.
Yeah.
Streaming is perfectly suited for that, because there is no install or anything. It's just logging in and saying, I want to be able to play that game for you know, 24 hours, and I'll pay you $5 or whatever.
I think that's the only viable model, because otherwise you're paying per game or to rent, and that's very asymmetrical. Is it relative to the price of the game or the length of the game? If you rent a game for 5 hours and it's only 5 hours long, like, could you beat it? Some publishers might not like that.
Exactly. I mean, like with Homefront, for example, if I'm a single player gamer and I you know, rent it for a day and I'm done, then THQ,
they just lost a sale, kind of.
Right. They completely lost the sale, because I finished what I was interested in that game. And
unless you wouldn't have bought it at full price and only played it because you could get it for $5.
Right. Right. But that's my point. Like, so if assuming I'm a guy who is a single player gamer, and I saw some trailers for Homefront showing the single player campaign, and like, oh, I want to play that. That I might otherwise have bought it, but instead I'm able to rent it, and therefore THQ loses that on a sale. So again, good for the gamer, not so good for the industry as it exists today, which, you know, and the forced transformation there could then become good for the gamer.
So then, do you think on live, if the technology works, and
which it does,
I guess if it works better.
Right.
If it gets to an acceptable point.
Right.
Is that bad for the industry then?
I mean, I don't know if the way their pricing model works right now, no, because it is, you are basically paying. They lowered the price at some point, but I don't know exactly what it is now, but at least when it launched, you were paying virtually full price to have access to, for example, Assassin's Creed 2. And so you would pay $50 or $60, or I forget
so
what.
So you'd essentially buy it, but when your subscription expired, you would
lose access to it.
Yeah.
And in addition, you pay for the online subscription. So it was not a good deal at launch. I do believe they lowered prices significantly, but I don't know exactly what it is right now.
Yeah. I mean, they'll adjust to the market. They'll adjust to what people want, I think, ultimately.
And what people are willing to pay for.
But do you think people want a PC loan service or a PC game loaning service?
This guy does.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people want to try before they buy. And it would, something like this would completely replace the need for demos, because you could have a timed setup. It's like, let me play this game for 10 minutes or 50 or half an hour or however long. And that would, you know, benefit developers, because they wouldn't have to spend time making a demo.
But then anymore. It's basically charging for demos.
Then. Well, yeah. They wouldn't necessarily charge for that, you know, that trial period, but yeah.
Anyway, interesting conversation. I mean, we're always open to more business models, more ideas, more ways of doing things, and hopefully we'll figure out the market and the industry will figure out a good solution.
And it's worth noting on that topic that GameStop recently bought in the same breath that they. The same mouthful that they bid off Impulse from Stardock. They also bought what's it called?
GameFly?
It's a streaming service. I forget what the name of it is, but that's also on our post about them buying Impulse.
Yep.
But it's a streaming service similar to OnLive.
Feel free to leave us a question for next week, or a comment on the website, of course. If you want to leave a question or a comment. In audio form, it's 877-404-1337, extension 724. Or you can email us an MP3 to pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com. I guess that about wraps it up for this week, unless you guys have any final thoughts.
I guess we got to do our playlist, though.
Right? Oh, gosh, that thing. Yeah. I don't really have one for this week because I've still been playing a game for review that I can't talk about yet. So I'm just going to pass it on to Josh.
All right. Well, I have enough to make up for you. So I jumped back into WoW. I kind of took a break since January.
Wow.
So I know it's been like 3 months. But my friend started playing a brand new mage, and my mage was level 74, and he was teasing me that he would hit level 85 before I would, and I cannot let that happen. That would be a great shame. So I jumped back in there on my mage, going through Northrend, which is just as boring as I remember it, and slow. League of Legends, been playing a lot of Nocturne, which is a new champion that came out a couple months ago. He's really fun. I love his ultimate. It has like that metagaming power where when you activate it, he's like a darkness champion or something. It removes line of sight from the entire enemy team and stops them from being able to see each other. Wow. And so all they can see is a tiny, tiny little bubble like as big as their feet around them for like 4 seconds. And then you can teleport to one of them. Like you swoop across. And it only lasts like 4 or 5 seconds. But it's just enough. Like I love picturing people freaking out every time it happens because they're like, oh God, he's going to get me. He's going to get me. And you see him like sprinting back to the tower trying to get safe. So that's a lot of fun. And I've also been jumping into Captain Bra, which is an adventure game I actually saw. We review it in the Portal 2 issue. And I totally agree with the review in there. It's one of the short reviews, so it's pretty short. But, I mean, you get plenty of flashbacks of, like, Curse of Monkey Island kind of era, like, in the style. And the hint system is great as someone who tends to not be as good as adventure games as I wish I were. I love the hint system because it's basically gradual. So by the end, if I hit 5 hints, like, it tells me exactly what to do if I get stuck. And then, yeah. I would also like to point out that platformers are really, really boring.
Which one in particular?
I started playing Cloning Clyde recently, and I've been playing, actually, Epic Mickey on the Wii. It's just so dull. There's, like, no story. All you do is,
There's running. There's jumping.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's shooting.
Yeah. And in Cloning Clyde, which is on Steam, actually, for just a few bucks, it's pretty cheap, you can actually, like, create clones of yourself and merge your DNA with, like, other animals. So you create, like, a chicken version of yourself. And so you get extra powers. But at the end of the day, it's just running and jumping. And it's like, okay, there's dynamite there. I'll clone myself with the dynamite. Now I can blow up walls. And then, okay, now I jump. And they're so dull.
Weren't we talking about this last week where platformers were just a genre that got abandoned because everything became about 3D, but they're still interesting? I mean, Super Meat Boy, Braid.
Have you played any Super Meat Boy, Josh?
I have not played Super Meat Boy. To be honest, I got scared away by how terribly difficult everyone said it was. It sounded like there was no way I'd be able to play.
It doesn't start out super duper difficult, yeah. So there is a curve. So I would love to see if that game is entertaining enough to keep you interested.
All right, I'll jump into Super Meat Boy this week and see. But yeah.
So I've played some among things I can talk about. I was playing some Anomaly Warzone Earth, which is, you know, it is a reversed reversed tower defense formula where you are the creeps going through the towers, and you get to kind of choose your path to approach certain towers from certain angles, and you arrange the order of your convoy of military vehicles so that, like, some of them are being covered by shield, and like the heavily armored APC is in the front, and the you know, lightly armored long range missile launcher is in the back, that kind of thing. And all the while you're running around as this little guy on foot who can run faster than the vehicles drive, and
impressive.
You know, yeah, you're picking up power ups and dropping calling down like smoke cover and doing repairs. And
can the turrets shoot you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you don't have free reign to run all the way around the map with it. You need the protection of your vehicles, and you have no direct damage abilities. So it's a very interesting game. I'm a little bit frustrated by it sometimes because just the conceit that I can't tell my vehicles to, hey, stop moving for a minute. It seems like a disconnect from how that would actually work. But other than that, it's a very interesting game. And there is a demo available now. So
is it on Steam?
It is on Steam.
How much is it?
I believe it's $10.
All right.
Awesome. And what was it called? Sorry.
Anomaly Warzone Earth. Or as I had to call it, Yo Mamaly.
Outstanding. Yeah, I love those kind of genre, like game mechanic reversals.
Yeah, it's very clever. Mm-hmm. And when I play a whole bunch of Defense Grid, that's like my favorite tower defense game. And last time I just picture like, oh, well, you know, if I were on the other side, here's how I'd beat these towers.
Totally.
So, I'm thrilled to see somebody actually do it.
Very cool. All right. That's all we got for you guys this week. Thanks for listening. Come find us and talk to us on PCGamer.com and leave us a comment. I love that somebody left us a truth, answer, falsity question. Hit us with some of those for next week and we'll try to get through them. That'd be really cool. All right. On behalf of Josh, Dan, and myself, we'll see you guys next week. Look forward to our Portal 2 issue. And of course, you'll hear all about it on the website and on the podcast next week. That'll be the big topic. No spoilers, of course.
The only thing that you could get spoiled from the review is like the way some of the new tools work.
Yeah.
So we're very careful not to give away much of the spoilers. Actually, if you don't want any spoilers, beware of screenshots, because for a big chunk of the game, you cannot take a screenshot without revealing something. So beware of that. If you're trying to dodge.
All right. With that disclaimer, go pick it up, guys. Look forward to it next week, and look forward to our conversation about Portal 2. See you then.